We all sleep better tonight if we open one eye, if we open one eye. Yeah, we all sleep better tonight if we open one eye, if we open one eye. Yeah, we all sleep better tonight if we open one eye, if we open one eye.
Yeah, we all. Okay, so I'm here with Juan Jose Campanella, who is the director of The Secret in Their Eyes. Juan Jose, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Now that I'm here with you, I'm even better.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, in fact, my own particular meter has jumped in your presence as well. So we're good on that score. Okay. I wanted to, first of all, start off with the obvious question, the question that you've no doubt been asked about over and over and over again. But I want to see if I can actually get an answer from you that's a little bit different, offer a kind of questionnaire approach that's different. And that is the wonderful, marvelous stadium shot that's in the middle of this movie. the sort of hybrid of Black Sunday and Touch of Evil.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
The question, I mean, obviously, I would love to ask you how you did this, but I'm also really curious how you got all these people in the stadium. I mean, I don't know what your budgetary scenario was.
Well, the budget was very low. As you know, it's a national Argentine movie, so we don't have millions and millions of dollars to do it. And we did it with the help of a few buttons and chips and stuff like that.
The wonderful CGI.
There's some of it is CGI, some of it is real. Mm-hmm. You never know what is what because we interspersed it.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't show, you know, so it wouldn't look like a PlayStation game.
Yeah.
But also, you know, most of the work was done not in populating the stadium, but in stitching the shots together.
Uh-huh.
You know, to make it look like one continuous take, and to make you feel like we were throwing you from a helicopter into the bleachers, and then chasing the guy together with our heroes.
Yeah. So the actual crowd, how many extras was that?
We had 300.
300, and you just basically composited over and over and over again.
Well, no, it's more involved than that because for the regular composition shot, you know, the we call it completion, you know, in Spanish. You need to have the camera locked. And the camera's moving here all the time. It's a handheld shot with a lot of crazy movement. We're actually in an avalanche of people at one point, you know, trying to keep ourselves standing.
Yeah.
So, you know, so no, you cannot do the completion trick.
Uh-huh.
No, it involves you know, the Massive software. It's called Massive. It was developed for Lord of the Rings. It's a very involved work, you know, for a very crafty work, you know. That's another thing, you know. People think that if you get the software, you can do it.
Yeah.
And it's not like that. This is the same thing as if I give you a brush and oil paint, and you can paint the Mona Lisa. You know, it's not like that. You do need real artists to pull it off.
Yeah, no, it's not just a bunch of monkeys typing Shakespeare.
Exactly,
a million
exactly.
monkeys, you know. well, this leads me to wonder. I mean, did you get like a bulk rate discount in terms of being able to get the effects right? Because here you are.
No, I have a VFX house in Argentina. You know, Ciembares, the production house, is also a VFX house, and so we did it in house, which allowed us to spend our sweet time doing it because we took 9 months to get every detail right.
9 months just for that shot?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And then the rest of the film probably didn't take 9 months.
Exactly.
To get it.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of, you know, there's a half of the film, as you know, takes place in 1974.
Yeah.
So obviously, you cannot imagine how many things changed from 1974 till today. Little things.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are no more payphones. A lot of stuff we had to do. There were 109 shots that had VFX in them.
Yeah. Did you use...
But they're all used for reality.
Yeah.
They're not apparent. You would never know that you're watching a movie that's heavy into you with VFX.
So this explains why when we go back to 1974, one thing I noticed was that you used very specific focal lengths. So that we really see a lot of these shots, and a lot of it's in soft focus in the back. It's very, very hard hard focus. Was this one of the reasons why?
No. That was completely expressive reasons.
Yeah.
We actually work with longer lenses because we this is a memory. It's his memory. You know, he's writing a novel of from his memory. So, you know, when you remember something that happened 25 years ago, you don't tend to remember every detail in the scene. Yeah. You tend to remember the most important things. Everything else is a little bit out of focus in your mind. Uh-huh. So that was, you know, in the present, we use wider lenses where everything is in focus. Yeah. And in the past, we concentrate on the action.
Well, this also leads me to actually find the red lamp that is in his home actually is now quite funny to me, because that's as delineated in both the present and in 1974.
Exactly.
So
this is a guy who never...
joke of yours. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also he's a guy who never changed. He still has a lava lamp.
Yeah.
I
wanted to also ask you about the scene where the boss chews out Esposito and Sandoval. I'm curious, from a directing standpoint... did you have to direct him to go completely over the top and then just shape it, or was that heavily rehearsed to get that absolute bureaucratic kind
This guy nailed it in the audition.
Uh-huh.
He was amazing. He totally nailed it in the audition.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that the actor himself he's a 60-year-old ex-hippie who is the farthest thing from a judge, and he looks like he was his entire life in that courtroom.
Yeah.
He completely nailed it. Basically, the challenge in shooting that scene was for us and the other actors to stop laughing because he was so serious and so determined in his idiocy that it was really a funny scene to shoot.
Well, you mentioned payphones in 1974 earlier. I must ask about the considerable paper that crops up in 1974. I mean, did you do research to get the exact levels of paper right? Was this poetic license?
It was very easy because it didn't change at all.
It didn't.
If you go to that courtroom, no. The only difference now is that while the files used to be sewn at that time, now they are stapled. But other than that, it's exactly the same. They have piles and piles and piles of files accumulating. We basically had nothing to change. We shot in a real courtroom, in a real court office, and we would come in at 6 in the afternoon. So all we did was just put their files on the floor and put our files for period on the, you know, reproducing it exact. And at the end of the day, we put our files back in. They would work in the morning, and we would come in. And the level, I think that in the Argentine judicial system, the paperless desk has not succeeded.
Yeah. Or in America even, too.
Yeah,
it's pretty much everywhere.
Exactly.
Well, that begs the question, if you're presenting this mess reflecting the office, certainly this might be cinematic misrepresentation of how neat it might be during the day.
No. It was exactly the same.
Okay. But in terms of what little details... did manage to change. What did you... I mean, I wanted to kind of talk about this. You had mentioned doing some effects for the 1974 flashbacks.
Well,
what
the train station was very different.
Yeah.
The train station, we basically had the same structure nowadays, but the trains are different. We didn't have period trains, so we had to erase the modern trains, create CGI versions of the older trains. In that immense lobby, which is like Grand Central.
Yeah.
Now it's full of kiosks with neon in the middle. We had to erase them all, replace the structure where we erased it, create people to walk around that. So that's also heavily CGI. And basically you don't have it here, but I was looking for those little strips of plastic where cables go through on the walls now.
Yeah.
You know, now the court offices are full of those, and those we couldn't take out, so we had to erase them, you know, digitally. We put fake walls. This we did for real. We put fake walls, fake old wooden walls on and this we did every day when we came in at 6 in the afternoon. You know, we just put the fake wall on the modern wall, and we took it out at the end of the day at 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
So the people who came to work wouldn't even notice that we were there.
Well, did you have a team of researchers on board to kind of nitpick little details and say, that one didn't happen in 1974?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. We also had, we were very lucky to have the architect who functioned as the boss of the They have a maintenance section for the court. This is like 60 court center here. It's a huge building. But they had one person who for 30 years was in charge of every little construction, every little partition, every little sheetrock wall that was created. He was in charge of that. So he knew exactly what everything, this was a walking data bank.
It was like the notary in the bar. Exactly. Which that also makes me wonder were all those sports statistics that he rattled off absolutely
real? They're all real.
They're all real.
Yes.
Well, and this also leads me to ask you, going back to, we haven't mentioned Eduardo
Sacheri.
Yes. Who also co-wrote the screenplay. Now, that's a little different from a lot of directors come around and they find a great novel and they go ahead and say, oh, I'll go ahead and work on it. But you actually had him work on the screenplay.
Oh, yeah. Well, I thought that his experience was invaluable. He worked in the court system for many years. And also, he knew the characters inside out. And if he was able to write a novel that was good enough for me to waste 2 years of my life turning it into a movie, I thought he was good enough to work on the script too. Yeah. So in our first conversation, what I did tell him was, you know, well, these are the things that I want to change. They're major changes. I think it's better for you as a novelist. The novel will still stand on its own. You know, and the novel will stand on its own and the movie will be a different thing based on the same idea and the same basic structure. I would love to write it with you. Let's suppose that you wrote a great classic theme and now we want to have a jam session and turn it into a jazz improvisation of your theme. This would be the same thing. And he liked that approach. And in fact, I had to stop him at some point and say, you know, I like it better in the novel.
So by the jam session, were you guys sitting in the same room?
Yes, we worked. I had some definite things that I wanted to change. I wanted to bring Irene to the foreground. In the novel, she takes no part in the case. She doesn't even work in the same office as they do. And I wanted the love story to be integral to the murder story. That was the biggest change. Also, the stadium scene, the fact that they find the guy in the novel, it happens by chance.
Yeah.
So I made them more active. So basically, I told him these things, and he agreed with them, and it was a real pleasure. It was a real pleasure to work together, yeah.
There's one, we have very little time, but I wanted to actually ask you about the philosophical question that is the underpinning of this film, the idea that one man has a singular passion. Now, that's a very general philosophical approach, but on the other hand, if we are looking at it through the fact that this is a flashback, then we might not necessarily construe this to be real. It's just perhaps as flimsy as Esposito's memory, and I'm curious about how much this theme was in the novel and how it actually made this transition to the film.
None of it was in the novel.
Really?
None of it. But this was all completely from the movie. But I don't think, you know, that's the way people find people who disappeared after many years. We turn it into passions, but when someone wants to disappear, you go and look for his vices, which are passions too, in a way, you know. So actually, that's where you look first. If someone was a gambler, let's say, you know that's something that's very hard to kick. There are certain passions that are very hard to kick, and that's what you look for first when you're looking for someone.
For you, is it strictly film, or are there other passions?
No, actually, film is losing some ground in the list of my passions. And my son has become my biggest passion.
Yeah.
Food has become a great passion, unfortunately. And music has become a passion. Reading has become a passion. And politics has become a passion. And then film is one of those, but only one. It used to be my only passion.
Good to break out. Well, anyway, I'm being kicked out of here. But Juan Jose, thanks very much for your time. No.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much.
We diverge now from the grand snap and crackle of Academy Award-winning directors to plunge once again into the literary world with a repeat guest. Alison Amond appeared on show number 256 and is the author of a sweeping new historical novel called Stations West. Please stick around. Allison, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Doing well. Good to see you again.
And you.
Yes. I wanted to first of all start with a painfully obvious and painfully general question, but I'm going to try to get into the nitty-gritty there, and that is 8 years from the original publication date of the one-story story that is at the very beginning of this finished novel. Describe this journey. Why did it take so long?
Wow. Well, yeah. I laughed. I cried. It was better than Cats. After the publication of one story, I started to work on it as a novel. So I started to continue. I'd already sort of conceived of it as possibly something larger. But when I got such a great reception in the one story, I sort of lit a fire under me. And I finished it, I think, in 2004. At which point I did the whole find an agent dance and did that. And then we went through a round of edits for about 6 months. And then she tried to sell it and couldn't. And that took a year. And then I put it under my bed and cried for a year. Yeah. And then I decided to start looking for publishers on my own. And that took a couple years. And then finally, actually, Hannah Tinti, who's the editor of One Story, spoke to Michael Griffith, who's the editor or the curator of the Yellow Shoe Fiction Series, which published my novel. And he mentioned he was looking for historical novels that had slipped through the cracks of the publishing, mainstream publishing world. And
did you mention that it slipped through your bed?
Yeah, exactly. The cracks in my bed slats. Yeah. And Hannah said, "Oh, I know a novel." So the rest is history.
I mean, we talked about this last time,
right?
Where you had the publisher was saying, "Oh, well, it's not sexy enough," and I was reading this going, "Well, there's plenty of sex in it."
Yeah, but it's not really sexy sex, you know.
Yeah, but it's true sex.
Yes.
I mean, and I'm wondering now that I've read the book, we could actually talk about why they rejected this and why it had to sit under a bed, so to speak, for so long.
Well, the obvious reason would be that I actually think it has pretty wide commercial appeal, but I could see how a publisher wouldn't think so. Because it deals with Jewish immigrants, publishers, you know, like to have the widest audience possible. And one publisher's complaint was that there was no female protagonist, and that women buy books and women want to read books about other women, which I thought was insulting to pretty much every segment of the population.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, then she wanted me to rewrite it, so I outlined another version of it for her, and then she said, you know, it needs to have more of a love story. And I thought, you know, you can't pick up a biography of Lincoln and be sad that it doesn't have information on Madonna in it. You know, this is just not that book,
But in terms of the female roles, mm-hmm. I mean, this book, to me anyway, seems very much about the role of women in this kind of patriarchal early settlement of America as well. So I'm wondering if you tried arguing with them about this at all, whether they were even receptive to this notion, or whether they were still caught in this regressive loop.
Yeah, no, they weren't particularly receptive to. I sort of understand that it's not publishers are not charities, and I have to try to remember this. You know that they're in a business to make money, and if they don't think they can make money off of your book, you know, they don't want to publish it. And I sort of understand that. I lament it, but I understand that. Yeah. And it came to a point where I wasn't willing to change it that much. If I had thought that I could sell it by changing it, I may have considered it. Mm-hmm. But it seemed both wrong and probably not going to work out. And that seemed like a lethal combination.
But there's plenty of violence in this book. In fact, violence, it's just dripping with violence. I mean, if that is not a saleable element, I mean, it's almost Peckinpah-like, so to speak. Was it more of the Jewish settler female heroine?
She said it was the woman. I actually had a meeting with one of the top executives at one of the top editors at a very, you know, well-known publishing house, which was great because I came in with a lot of good hardcover books, which I subsequently sold to The Strand for money. But after reading them, but but she, you know, and she seemed to think that it was really the lack of a female protagonist. And though, like you said, there are very strong female characters who are well developed, the protagonists are men.
Yeah. Do you feel that, I'm sorry to stick on this, because it just seems unfathomable to me, because I agree with you that the book has commercial appeal, but do you think that the fact that you were a woman writer, this was one of the reasons that this is an innate patriarchal part of the publishing industry as we know it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because publishing is, you know, is mostly populated by women.
Yeah, I know.
As you know, yeah. So it's interesting that there would be a sort of, prejudice against, you know. And I would hate to say that it, you know, I don't know enough about the publishing industry to make a blanket judgment like that. I would say in this case, it seemed as though I was not the writer she expected, and this was not the book that she was looking for.
All right, well, we'll get off that topic and grill you like Mike Wallace. let's actually talk about the book itself. Okay. I wanted to first of all ask about how much the Stephen Crane principle applied to executing this historical setting. I mean, of course, the Stephen King for that matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Stephen Crane principle is, of course, he never saw a single battle, and yet he wrote The Red Badge of Courage. Mm-hmm. You clearly did not actually settle into the Old West or canned foods or run a store.
No, I've not.
At least not to my knowledge.
I did work at a hot dog stand once.
I'm curious how much invention went into this and how much you were concerned about getting verisimilitude for the 80-year epoch that you explore.
I was originally not particularly concerned with either of those things. I had to do a lot of research even just to know what I was dealing with. And then I went to hear randomly E.L. Doctorow speak, you know, who's the king of setting books in, you know, historical settings. And, and he said, oh, you don't have to do research, you know, just make it up. You've seen enough TV and watched enough movies. He said, you probably get it right. And if not, someone will tell you, which is easy for him to say since he has like 7 paid research assistants. But, but that was really liberating. And I thought, you know, I have seen enough old Westerns and I've been to Oklahoma. I'll just, you know, let me just write the book. And the truth is that, you know, there's never, you know, there's no plot twist that hinges on an invention that hadn't been invented yet. Everything was changeable. And for a while there in the middle, I was working with the University of Oklahoma Press. They had it read by a historian of Oklahoma. Who tore the book to shreds. He's like, well, I couldn't get past page 5. You know, the author says that the landscape is very arid and that part of Oklahoma is actually very lush. And, you know, therefore this book is, you know, can't be considered as a legitimate work. And I said, okay, cross out arid, insert the word lush. It doesn't change the character development, you know.
Who's this guy?
he was anonymous because he was a peer reviewer, which is part of the problem with the university presses.
I noticed that there was a reference to him in the acknowledgments.
Yes, it's actually not him. That was a very wonderful editor who worked with me, who actually subsequently died of stomach cancer, which is very sad. But the reviewer in question was known as Mr. Grouchy Pants.
Yeah.
So, and I do not know who he is. And if he's hearing this interview, I changed arid to lush to arid, or arid to lush. So
did he set up an anonymous email account? Did he telephone you?
Oh no, it was like a 5-page report that he sent to the editor, who then forwarded it to me.
With mysterious initials at the end?
Yeah, no, it was just like, it wasn't.
Wow, that's how they do things over.
Yeah, well, you know, it was university press, so the procedure there is that everything goes through a peer review.
Yeah,
which makes a lot of sense if you're publishing a textbook or a piece of scholarship.
Yeah.
Less sense if you're publishing fiction. Yeah. But they could not seem to get beyond that step. So
this is probably the craziest editing process probably that you've gone through, I would guess.
Oh, for sure. Although, you know, my path to the publishing world has been non-traditional, let's put it that way.
I mean, I can't even imagine working with an editor who is speaking behind like Charlie's Angels or something.
Yeah, no, it really was. Know? It came from like a box on the wall,
behind the red door or something like that. Well, going back to the believability and the research, I mean, at what points did you feel that you kind of knew the locale, the time, and the place, and you were able to essentially invent and let go? I mean, it seems to me like, for example, the Pullman car that shows up, you were very careful to describe it, and then once you got past that description, you were able to essentially execute the narrative. But here you are living in New York City, you're surrounded by technology, as I see here.
Yeah.
So did you have to take any steps to get your headspace into 100 years ago in any capacity, or to remember, oh no, they didn't have a telephone, or they, you know, there's a telephone that shows up, but they didn't have a lot of the technologies that we take for granted today.
It's true. Well, it was challenging in the sense that you know, a lot of the plot elements I'm used to rely on technology, on things beeping or ringing to interrupt, and you know, that wasn't the case then. But there was always, you know, the equivalent of the cell phone, even if it wasn't a technological, you know, like the horse would arrive with the month's mail, you know, like, you know. And I'm a train enthusiast, which is kind of strange for a woman living in New York City, but so I'd been.
I'm a train enthusiast too.
Okay, so I've been to a bunch of train
I'm
museums.
Not a woman. I think I should grow breasts. I don't know, but
you could. They have drugs for that. Yeah. So I'd been to a bunch of train museums, and I actually really like research. It's because writers do everything possible to avoid writing. Mm-hmm. So research is fantastic because you can pretend like you're writing, but you actually don't have to, which is great. So at one point I sort of said, okay, that's enough, that's enough research. And it was a challenge too to make sure it doesn't read like, and I've read historical novels that are like this, that read like a textbook where the author's like, look, I really know about this time period. See, because I told you what kind of velvet there was on the chairs,
I know.
And I was really trying to avoid that. And for a while it was kind of a Forrest Gump novel where my characters were present at like every single major American event. So they were like in Chicago for the Pullman strike. They were at the World's Fair. Then they were like, part of the grape, like pickers in California. And then I was like, okay, they have to just sort of, they have to be where they are.
Yeah.
And if they're going to miss a lot of events. And that's when it occurred to me to have them miss the land rush.
So the Harvey's Girl thing, as well as the many names such as Garfield and the like, are sort of vestiges of the Forrest Gump version of the novel? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I was really interested in the Harvey House once I found out about them, these restaurants that were in every sort of, and most train stations across the nation.
The Hojo of its time.
It was the Hojo or the McDonald's of its time, right? And that they were staffed by women and the women had to be good girls, you know, and that was...
It's all Hooters-like, actually.
Yeah, it is, actually. Yeah.
I wanted to also ask you, there's a lot of internal rhyme in this novel, internal rhyme within sentences, and which was a surprise to me because, I've read your short story collection, and there wasn't so much internal rhyme.
Huh.
And I wanted to ask you whether having either a morpheme or a particular unit allowed you to really kind of fixate upon putting together a sentence. Maybe you can talk about this capacity. A lot of rhyming within the sentence.
Interesting. It had never occurred to me. No one's ever said that. But last time we had an interview, you found four instances of me mentioning Zima in my work, which I hadn't known either. So I think what I can say is that there were many points at which the novel was horribly, horribly overwritten.
Mm.
And I have a tendency to overwrite anyway, but this stuck in there long after it should, and I really had to go through and pare it. So I'm wondering if that comes from...
Two sentences merging together like that?
Yeah, or just too many adjectives and adverbs in the sentence that needed to come out. I was looking for the right word and put them all in there.
Well, by overwriting, give me an example of this.
Instead of people walking, they walked in a certain, with a lope that was reminiscent of, the gait that so-and-so had used. Just was sort of, or there'd be a whole bunch of adjectives strung together to describe, a chair.
Yeah.
They didn't need to be there. I needed to put them there in order to get to the description of the chair, but they needed to come out after that. And also it was, it's written in the present tense, and it's a much different style than my first book was, so it's a lot. And I think in some ways I was unconsciously or consciously not mimicking, but paying homage to, the 19th century novel.
Yeah. So you needed to overwrite in order to get the precision that is there in the final draft, that you needed to get all these details out of your system to figure out what the more prominent details were.
Right. And then there was, I was describing a lot of things I hadn't seen and wasn't used to. And so it was more challenging to find ways to describe it, and also to make sure that the descriptions weren't anachronistic. You can't say, it was as small as a cell phone because there were no cell phones. It was as small as, and then I'd have to do a little bunch of research to think of something that was, about the size of my hand that existed back then. The smallest iron in the set. Okay,
So. I wanted to ask also about the eugenics and multiculturalism. This is rather interesting. Of course, Moshe is half Cherokee, half Jewish, and there's a lot of fusion, but I must say that I was a little distressed by the Lamarckian description of Napoleon Pickney, just to name one. I'll read this little passage. He's a particularly ugly American of America's melting pot, an amalgam of each race's worst characteristics, a long sloping forehead covered by cowlicked red Scottish hair, a flat truncated nose, which is red in the Irish way, and lies flat against his pale Scandinavian skin. He has burly Italian forearms and a skinny English torso. In short, he is unsightly and imposing enough that no one thinks to ask where he comes from. Now, that could be read almost as a sort of a troubling endorsement of race-centric attitudes during that time, or it could be read with irony. I'm curious if you could. I mean, people don't necessarily blend that way.
Yeah, you know? No, it's true. They don't necessarily. But then you've seen somebody like that, you know, yeah. who feels like they've been put together with all the leftover parts of every, you know, every race, or the people who seem put together with all the best parts of every, yeah. you know, you see them in New York all the time. I lived in Europe a lot as an adult, and those societies, while they are changing, are still very homogenous. And so people really, everybody looks French in France. You know, and I can walk down the street with clothes I bought in France, with my hair done by a French, you know, hairdresser, and I don't look French. And that was sort of interesting to me, that Americans, you know, we're all mutts, right? Or most of us are mutts. And I thought that was sort of an interesting place of origin, that as an American, for example, my characters are trying to sort of find roots and assimilate while still holding on to their own culture. But you know, that dance is difficult for them because they come from a different country in a way that makes America unique. And I think he's sort of the character you read about, Pinckney, is sort of a comic. I mean, that's supposed to be sort of somewhat comical, ironic, yeah. that like, this is, you know, this is the extreme of that mix.
On the other hand, human beings are not necessarily erector sets. That's why I was kind of, you know, a little, whether that was ironic or whether that was more of a sincere description of him. I mean, the multiculturalist in me was kind of, you know, suspicious of that.
Obviously. I mean, yes, and it's supposed to be, that part of the novel is somewhat from the point of view of the quote-unquote church ladies who are yeah. in the town, and so it's sort of, the picking apart of him is their sort of view of, like you said, like the sort of the obsession with what stock you come from, even though it's, you know, nobody comes from stock.
Yeah, yeah. Is that why his name was Pinckney, or...?
Yeah, you know, that's with apologies to Pinckney Benedict. I read his name on my friend's email and was like, I want that name. And now I've since met him, and he's a lovely man. He looks nothing like my
Napoleon character. That's the trouble with names. I mean, yeah. Were there any other? I noticed a few of the names. I was just Googling them at random, mm-hmm. and there was historical precedent for some of them.
Yeah,
and so I'm curious if you feel that naming characters after a particular individual in the books or that you know is mm-hmm. is a more comfortable way for you to really kind of get at their, I suppose, invented character, or they're running away from the reality.
Yeah, their avatar.
Yeah, it's I'm trying not to use modern terms for historical.
Right, sorry,
novel.
Yes.
But yes, their avatar.
Their simulacrum. Yes. I actually tend to use I don't know any people named any of these things in and I think I have trouble using names of people I know.
Yeah.
There's nobody named Sarah in any of my stories because it reminds me too much of Sarah.
Yeah.
You know? And a lot of the names, not the names of the protagonists, but the names of the sort of the, you know, the characters who wander in and out, the secondary or the tertiary characters, are lifted literally from like census lists of the time
really?
And the place. So,
How much time did you spend scouring through census?
Well, not that time. It would sort of like I would get a, you know, a book of, you know, life in the 1800s and there'd be a list there, you know, they'd be quoting some newspaper event that happened, you know, and then I would sort of, I'm like, oh, that's a good name. I'll take that one. Thank you. So, I'd mix them up. Yeah.
Were there any descriptive details that worked along these lines of just plucking them from your research or things that you ran into?
There are a couple of found documents in the novel. One of the letters that's in there that comes from the government is a found document. The other one I made up in the style of the government writing.
I presume there is no form RF18132.
Not to my knowledge. Yes, that dissolves a marriage. No, not to my knowledge. So how much time did I spend? I spent more time poring over census records than I needed to be honest. But, you know, it's a good, like I said, it's an excellent procrastination method.
Well, is there a danger of ingesting too much information during
Absolutely. And then you can't, you know, let your flights of fancy, you know, take place.
Why not?
Well, because then you're sort of so inundated with information that you block yourself. You know, when you know something to be not possible or not true or didn't happen, then you can't imagine it and find a way for it to happen, you know. I think some of the things that happen in this novel are unlikely. Let's call it unlikely, you know. I think it's unlikely that a family of Swedish immigrants would move in with a a single Jewish Cherokee father and his son, but you know, just because it was unlikely doesn't mean that it can't happen or that it wouldn't make a good story, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. I actually wanted to ask you also about dialogue. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have we don't have recorded phonographs of the way that people spoke.
Right.
We do have court documents and deposition testimony. Did you delve into anything along those lines to get the dialogue, or did you invent along the lines of, say, the Swedish scenario that you suggested just now?
Yeah, no, I made all of that up, and I have no idea if it... I hope it sounds realistic or plausible. I decided not to write in dialect, although it was tempting to try to do so, just because I knew that... I felt like it would just be... it would be too ripe for parody, you know, to try to write in dialect. And so everyone sounds somewhat the same, even though they probably had very, very drastically different accents and diction. Yeah. But hopefully that works for the novel.
Yeah. Well, that makes me wonder, in terms of the dialogue, whether you just cut it down to the plainest possible speech precisely for this reason.
Well, my characters are very taciturn. My characters are not talkative people, unlike my previous book where everyone talked a ton, and I talk a ton. But these characters are very stoic. Sometimes there's nobody to talk to. Sometimes they can't voice their emotions or don't know what they are. Sometimes there's no language available to them, you know. And so the dialogue became spare just out of, you know, out of necessity. There wasn't a lot for them to say.
But there's also a few passages I noticed where you describe what they're saying to each other, and you don't actually produce dialogue, particularly in the...
Indirect discourse.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I'm curious if this was just one of those tricks with which to, I suppose, postpone the inevitable. I mean, you have to have characters speak, even if it is a particular setting that that you don't necessarily live in.
Yeah. I hope it wasn't. That sounds like lazy writing. Also, too, I think the narrator of this novel is very removed. And the idea was originally in the book that the narrator would start off very, very removed and end up much closer to the characters. And then I decided that was sort of an artifice that the book didn't need. But I do like the fact, and left it in on purpose, that it begins with a very distant narrator who doesn't even necessarily know everything that happened, in the way that we don't really know who the first Jewish immigrant in Oklahoma was, or who exactly, you know, who exactly populated the state. And that the narrator sort of grows more knowledgeable along with the reader as history gets less distant and more recent.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about the many years that this book takes place in. And you had mentioned earlier the fact that, of course, back then you got months old news. It took months for items you needed to arrive, which occurs in this book. But the interesting thing about that, you know, waiting for these things to arrive for several months is that the years actually pass by quite swiftly. And I'm curious, from a time centric momentum, what you did to just kind of keep things whittled down like that. There are some sections, of course, that in which 10 years pass by. There are some sections in which it's like only 2 years.
Yeah, or a week, I think. One's all in the same year, I think. Yeah. I think a lot of that comes from how the idea for the book came to me, which was that I was, my grandparents are from Oklahoma, and I was cleaning out their house after they'd passed away, and I found this book called The Jews of Oklahoma, and it's like a 5-page book, which I thought was really funny.
5 pages?
It's like a pamphlet. Yeah, exactly.
I used to put those together in school, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's slightly...
I made a book, yeah.
Slightly bigger than that, but not much. And I thought that was hysterical. I mean, it was like funny, but then I was like, oh, this has to be a story. And then as it became... you know, it assumed more importance in my life, I realized I wanted to sort of understand how you could start with, you know, Boggy Horwitz, the first immigrant in, you know, what will become Oklahoma in 1859, end up with Alice and Amond in, you know, Manhattan in 2010. And so I think that I felt the book had to span a lot of years so that I could really sort of understand the trajectory of that. Which then is also, of course, a trajectory of the development of the Southwest, and then also, of course, a trajectory of the development of America, too.
Got it. Well, I mean, I'm curious if you had the idea of this expansive, protracted timeline set up in advance when you started the novel.
Yeah.
You did?
Okay. Yeah, I always thought I sort of wanted to end it. I wasn't sure exactly where, but I sort of thought I wanted to end it. I actually thought it would involve my grandparents, and it stopped before. Although, actually, that's not true. I wonder if the last generation in the book might be my grandparents' generation.
Were your grandparents shop owners? Or?
No. Well, my great-great-grandfather was a peddler who then owned, yes, and who then owned a dry goods store in Texas, and who then his whole family, my grandmother's whole family passed away in a car accident on New Year's Eve in 1925, 33, I can't remember what the exact date is. Yeah. So I took that incident from, you know, from my actual history, and I said it way back then.
The violence and death that I had mentioned earlier, with perhaps too much relish. I'm curious if this came about largely to reflect the violence of history or the violence of this narrative in order to, you know, keep things moving along. You have an unexpected death, have an unexpected fire, have an unexpected accident on a train.
The research I read, I mean, unexpected deaths were almost expected, you know. I mean,
Expecting unexpected.
I mean, life was very difficult, and especially on the, you know, especially in an unsettled land. And violence. There were violence when technology came in, you know, train accidents, gun accidents. There was violence between people who wanted to, you know, share the same land, whether it was, you know, Native Americans and settlers sort of, you know, fighting. And then people were always succumbing to, you know, diseases that would, you know, no one had resistance to any of these diseases that would arrive. And so if you read any of the narratives from that time, it's like almost like a history of the ways in which humans can perish.
But I would say that you took a certain, at least I detected a certain giddiness with much of the violence. I mean, for example, Jackie's fate. I'm going to do my best not to spoil things, but Jackie's fate is quite comic, because here you have this major relationship forming. Moshe is finally befriending an African American, and just as he's like, "Oh, okay," and not only that, but this is good just for race relations as well.
Right.
And then, you know, he's gone just like that.
Yeah.
And so there's something rather comic about that. And
it says a lot about you, actually.
Well, I found it to be fun, both funny and tragic at the same time.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you took a particular glee in some of the violence while writing this.
I hope it wasn't glee, but I did. I was shocked.
Pleasure, maybe.
I was shocked and interested when I read about, especially about trains, how dangerous it was. I mean, there's really no modern job that was nearly as dangerous. I mean, the closest we come are sandhogs who, you know, build on the ground. But there's, I mean, I don't know what the statistics are for train workers who died while working on trains, but it was some ridiculous amount of people who just would lose limbs in train coupling accidents, be pushed under the rails, fall under the rails. There were a million ways to hurt yourself on a train. And so it just seemed like somebody on the train had to, you know, had to die in a train accident, or it wouldn't be realistic. You know?
But you set this whole situation up, and we think, oh, okay, Jackie's going to be maybe perhaps a major part of the character, and then no, he's not.
Yeah.
And that's why I have to ask. This goes back to the question of whether it suits the needs of narrative or it suits the needs of history.
Yeah.
Because or do the
hopefully
do the points
it's
intertwine?
Both. I hope it's both. My mother read a very early draft. She goes, "Does it have to be so sad?" And, you know, I don't think it's all sad. I find parts of it very comic. Hopefully other people will also, but, you know, but it's, you know, it's not a happy story. Life was tough, but I hope it's not there as just, you know, as some sort of prurient pleasure that I took in writing about the death of these people or making my characters suffer.
Whoa.
I mean, hopefully it serves some narrative purpose, that it, you know, it helps develop the character into who he is.
Well, just because it serves a narrative purpose doesn't necessarily mean it can't be pleasurable to some degree. I mean, like, T.C. Boyle loves to, like, have his character suffer.
Okay, yeah, I like
do you to love
to
have your
things.
Character
I
suffer?
Do,
yeah,
I do,
yeah.
All right.
I do it.
You finally dragged it out of me. And I actually, I really like to kill animals in fiction, but I restrain myself a lot in this novel because I think probably because I was killing off so many people. I didn't have to kill off the animals the way I used to.
Yeah, no. Of course, historically, there was no mention of Zima, so I won't ask
you about that. There was no mention of Zima.
I wanted to ask you, though, about Garfield, who is quite the scoundrel, I must say.
Yeah.
You know, but... But then so is Boggy in the prologue.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of interesting to me because it almost suggests that there is this kind of quality that skips a generation. Because Moshe is more or less a decent guy. I mean, mm-hmm. he's got his issues, mm-hmm. but he's nowhere nearly as scabrous as either Garfield or Boggy. And I'm curious if this was a concern for you, particularly since families often come together and break up and come together and break up.
Yeah.
I mean, I lost count after the eighth time or something like this. I'm curious if you were, how concerned you were with this kind of generational character quality or familial quality carryover over the course of many generations.
Well, you know, I don't, to me, well, let's start with, to me, Garfield's actually, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for him and I like him immensely and feel very sorry for him. And I feel like he is misunderstood by those around him and that he's always trying to do what he thinks is for the best. And he's so misguided and so damaged that usually ends up being the worst possible thing he could do for himself and for others. So, and throughout his life, you know, so many things happen to thwart anything good in him that he becomes a very sort of grouchy old person. But you know, to me, this sort of love, lifelong love he shares with Dora, and to me it is a real love affair. It may not, you know, it doesn't end with violins and rose petals, but, you know, it is a real love affair to the best of both of their abilities, is evidence of that there's something inside him that's, you know, decent and good and just cannot get out.
Well, this actually brings up another question I wanted to throw at you, and that is the fact that you are really specific about certain details while also keeping these characters a mystery or subject to reader interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
I had mentioned the particular sexual details that really tell us everything we need to know
mm-hmm.
about Moshe and Alice and even later on. And I'm curious though, because a lot of things we are left to infer and in the whacking away of overwriting.
Yeah.
I'm curious what, if you placed any particular priority on what to spell out and what to leave open to this reader interpretation. I mean, it's a very interesting tension because it's like we think we know the character and then there are certain details like, well, we aren't entirely certain precisely how Garfield turns from this path towards the good. We're not entirely certain why that violence exists within him, for example.
Yeah.
And
okay,
so,
that's fair enough. You know, I don't know. This book took so many twists and turns getting to print. That, and I actually think, well, I feel like it got better and better and better, but it did get shorter and shorter and shorter. And I just read a review in Time Out Chicago that, you know, she said, you know, and she, you know, she packs it all into 250 pages. And I thought, that's how long it is? Because at one point it was over 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
So it really, really did get whittled down. And I was, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot today, actually, like really 250 pages? How did it end up so short? But I think, every cut hopefully took away something that didn't need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think a lot of history is somewhat unknowable, and I like that idea for a historical novel.
But are there details that were there in the 1,000 draft that you really regret? I mean, obviously you had to drown a few babies along the way.
Oh, yeah, but you always want to kill your darlings.
Yeah,
yeah. There's a whole, wonderful, I think it's wonderful. There's a whole section in takes place in Chicago in the 20s that I keep trying to sell to somebody as a short story that nobody wants. But that got lost. At one point, there was a modern woman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who was like looking for her ancestors on a postcard she found. That was like 300 pages that I tossed out. And some of it actually, I part of the problem with this process, as long as it's taken, is that there are things that I probably think are still in there that aren't in there anymore. You know, that
the point you can't rectify or reconcile all the drafts.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, I think there are things in there that aren't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe, and I don't mind that actually, because it probably makes the narration seem surer.
Yeah.
But it does get, you know, like, remember the part where everyone's like, no, that wasn't in the book. Dangers of 8 years, exactly, yeah.
There's one last question I had for you, and that was actually in relation to the rather surprisingly thoughtful column you wrote in the normally superficial Modern Love section of the New York Times, the Turner Syndrome article. Yeah. How did you get them to publish something thoughtful? I was surprised. I was like, wow, here's a really like a
lot
meaningful...
of money and offer sexual services. Yeah, it's very demeaning. It's interesting because a lot of people have said that to me, and I actually really like Modern Love, and I've always sort of dreamt of publishing something there. And, you know, well, it's not always the deepest thing. I actually find it to be decent, like pretty well written and often thought-provoking, but apparently nobody else on the planet thinks that, so I'm going to guess that I'm wrong about that. My agent sent it in, but they do take, you know, they'll take, they read everything that comes across the desk, and the editor liked it and wanted to publish it, so, you know, and that was... It was a really, it's been a really interesting experience. I've gotten a lot of mail about it. You know, almost all of it really supportive. Some people want to heal me with their crystals. but yeah.
What kind of crystals?
I don't know. I did not pursue that email. Yeah.
I mean, New Age, meth.
I think it was New Age. It was, well, I don't want to offend anybody, but yes, I got a very new agey email, and that was, but it was nice, you know.
A lot of New Age people read Modern
Apparently Love. Apparently so. A lot of people read Modern Love, and people kept coming out of the woodwork, you know, like people's grandfathers would call them and be like, oh, I read that column by your friend. You know, Grandpa reads Modern Love? Apparently so.
Yeah. Allison, again, it was a great pleasure to talk. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It was great to be interviewed by you.
Yeah, thank you.